Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining this medcast entitled A Patient-Centric Medcast on the Journey Through Moderate Plaque Psoriasis. I'm Lauren Miller. I'm a dermatology PA. I practice in Oxford, Alabama with Southern Skies Dermatology and Surgery. And today I'm joined by a friend and colleague of mine, Jamie Heim. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Lauren. How are you today?
I'm good. You want to introduce yourself? Obviously, I just said your name, but where you practice and a little background.
Certainly. I'm Jamie Heim, and I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I practice in Granville, Michigan at West Michigan Dermatology.
Awesome. Well, it's so good to talk with you again today. We've done a few of these together, and it's always so much fun. So I'm excited about today. In today's program, we're going to discuss exciting developments in the treatment landscape of plaque psoriasis. And both of us are going to share our insights on what is often challenging journey for patients that they go on. But there are some new, really novel systemic treatments that have given us the opportunity to kind of get rid of this burden of chronic disease that plaque psoriasis is. And to discuss more of this, we are joined today by Terry Fillet, PAC. Hi, Terry.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. It's so good to have you. Thank you for joining us. Terry, why don't you tell us where you practice and a little bit about your practice and background?
I am a dermatology PA. I've been practicing for now probably 15 years here in Houston, and totally all in Houston the entire time. I previously worked in rheumatology before coming to derm. So that's probably one of the things I love, and truly when we're talking about inflammatory disease states, and truly just all encompassing. So that's all that's about me.
That's great. I think that is so unique and really helpful that you have that rheumatology background. I'm actually a little jealous. I know that has to come in handy during the day when you're treating these inflammatory disease patients. So I'm going to have to get your number and do a phone a friend. All right, well, let's begin. So the impact of psoriasis on health, we know, is not just limited to the skin. And often in dermatology, it's a little tempting to just be more visual when we're doing our exam. But we also need to remember that we know now there's some systemic diseases that can be associated with plaque psoriasis. We also know now that there's pretty profound psychosocial impact that goes along with plaque psoriasis and really all inflammatory skin diseases. So Terry, I wanted to talk to you about that and maybe kind of let us in on how you approach the comorbidities that go along with inflammatory skin diseases, namely plaque psoriasis, and how you kind of take that into account when you're working up a psoriasis patient.
It's kind of interesting we talk about that just because of the fact that we know that there's so much more that we know now in regards to psoriasis and just understanding just the pathogenesis of it, but not only that, just the psychosocial component that honestly really affects our patients deeply. And I think when we look at the comorbidities like IBD and we look at cardiovascular disease and even metabolic syndrome, a lot of times I think when we're looking at our patient holistically, not just in the sense of when we used to look at psoriasis just from a skin component and just say, okay, well, this is just a skin disease, I'm just treating just the skin. And it's like, no, I think that our understanding has broadened to know that, you know, there is a systemic immune, you know, component that is going on in these patients. One is the understanding of the disease, but at the same time, I think it then kind of transfers how we look at them. So a lot of times I find myself that when I'm looking at these patients, number one is educating them on what's going on. And then number two, then I then begin to unpack what the disease, the impact has had on them, whether it be that they are depressed or they have anxiety. And it truly isn't. I mean, it's a remarkable just when you kind of really talk to patients, how much the disease impacts their day to day. And then I think when we're kind of thinking about how to treat them, I think when we're taking that all into account, I think patients then feel like, you know what, this doc is hearing me, this PA is hearing me in regards to how this has impacted me. And not only that, they're wanting to treat me accordingly, not just give me something to put on my skin, but saying, you know what, I identify that you do itch. And it's real. And so I think sometimes that's how I kind of approach so far as in regards to treatment.
Yeah. Jamie, would you agree? Is there anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I agree 100%. I think I want to add on to it a little bit, because what Terry said is just right on point. The one thing I'd like to add on to it is that we're just constantly evolving. Our knowledge that we're talking to our patients about is constantly evolving. Just like Carrie was talking about the comorbidities and that, we know that the comorbidities are really important because of the inflammatory properties of this disease. But now we also have new information. We have information not only regarding the past about diabetes and cardiovascular disease and that, we see our patients that they have a large degree of hypo or hypothyroidism, but now we're seeing a relationship between bolus diseases such as bolus pemphigoid. We're seeing a correlation between asthma, and we're also seeing a correlation between the periodontitis type diseases. Those types of diseases also have been closely related to patients that have inverse psoriasis. And so we're evolving more and more. So our education to our patients is becoming really essential. And Terry really mentioned about the quality of life for those patients. I recently had a patient and he came to me and he said to me, I don't know if you can help me with this, but he had severe psoriasis. I mean, he had 50% body surface area. He needed to be treated with systemic therapy. And he said, I have been in depression, he said, because of the psoriasis, and I haven't found anybody to help me. And he had prone into tax evasion problems. And so, and you know, looking at that, and depression and just suicidal ideation, as well as accomplished suicides, are higher with patients with psoriasis. So we really need to evaluate this closely and to educate our patients.
Oftentimes patients will say, nobody's ever asked me how I actually feel. They ask me about, you know, how my skin feels. And they talk to me about how it looks and how we're going to get that better. But nobody's actually ever asked me, you know, mentally or emotionally how I feel. And I think that goes a long way to make these patients feel like we are really dedicated to making them better holistically and not just from a skin standpoint. Unfortunately, we know that there's a lot of patients, like you just spoke of, that are untreated, or even worse to me is they're undertreated. Why do you think that is, Terry? Why do you think that there's patients that are seeking care and they're going to, you know, dermatologists, and they're still only being treated, let's say, topically, when maybe they should be treated with systemic therapy?
I think it's kind of multifocal. I think you probably have some patients that obviously, you know, weirdly enough, I mean, some patients, despite the fact that they have probably moderate to far severe disease, many of them they don't like topicals, but to some degree, the thought of actually going to something more aggressive sometimes is a little bit unnerving. And so the minute that you mentioned something that is a little bit more intense, it's just like, oh, you know, they're still unpacking the fact that they are having something that's actually not just skin related, because that's all they've known for several years and decades. So I think that there's the educational component that in relation to patients and what they feel comfortable with, whether or not they are okay going to being on an injectable and getting injected. You know, some patients are just like, okay, yeah, you kind of crossed the line there. And then some, it's a case where they're not as fearful of that. And then I think from the provider standpoint, I think that at the same time, it's just like we talked about before, it's truly, I think that we're in a stage and place where I feel like if we know better, we do better. And so knowledge in itself is that we are now unpacking so far as the pathogenesis of psoriasis. And honestly, we're still constantly learning so far as we're looking at all the different players and cytokines that are involved. I think our understanding has definitely broadened, but I think that there are definitely still some providers out there that are still kind of just like, well, they've been treating a specific way all these years. And, you know, their comfortability sometimes is not there in going to some systemic agents. And I hope to believe that we begin to get past that, because our patients need it. I mean, when they come through the door, they're wanting help. And I think that that's our due diligence, that we're giving them the best care that's possible and that's available now. Because sometimes, you know, we can be stuck in our mindset of what we were treating with, you know, 10, 20 years ago. That's why you have tons of scripts of, you know, the clobetasols and different things floating around, because it's what we're used to. And so I kind of come to the point that, you know what, you know, we know better, we do better. So we got a lot more in our arsenal to work with. I think that our patients deserve that. So.
Right. Jamie, is there anything you would want to add? Any thoughts on why patients are still undertreated?
You know, I love that Terry's statement, to know better, do better. I think know better, do better is really, really true. I think it is multifocal. That statement also can be on the patient's part as well as the provider's part. Because I have, on the other hand, because I specialize in psoriasis and have for almost 2 decades, patients that come to me and tell me how many dermatology providers that they have seen and that they have not gotten the care that they need. They are literally wanting better care. They know that, you know, they've, like Terry said, lots of times they look on the internet, they are aware of psoriatic arthritis, they have questions about it, their skin, they're uncomfortable, they're sick of the flaking. They in fact, they get to the point where they don't even know what it's like to have normal skin anymore. It's really hard, and they want better. And we need to do better. And so I think a lot of times that as providers ourselves, we need to educate ourselves more. That's what I love about platforms like this, because we're reaching out, we're talking about it, we're educating. And don't be afraid to treat these patients. These patients really do want care. And like Terry said, you know, sometimes they've gotten so comfortable being at where they're at, but there are so many other patients that are not comfortable at all being where they're at. And a lot of it too, sometimes, is a fear, just from looking at the commercials and thinking of side effects in that. And when you talk to them, because we're educated, we really know the background of where the biologics and, you know, large molecule and small molecule medications and how they interact in the and how the FDA goes ahead and they label things. And I think that that's a part of our education to our patients too. And we need to educate ourselves on that so we can educate our patients. But we can do more. I think know better and do better is really important.
I know over the years, I've come into contact with PAs and MPs that have collaborative physicians that they themselves don't prescribe systemic therapies and biologics, or perhaps they're doing some of the older systemics and not utilizing the newer ones, and they prevent their PAs and MPs from prescribing those. So I know that can be an issue as well. But I also know that I've spoken to providers who really have a hard time kind of distinguishing that moderate patient, which we know these systemics and biologics are indicated most of the time for moderate to severe disease. And, you know, I think we all can agree that it's easy to pinpoint that mild patient and it's pretty easy to pinpoint the severe patient. But, you know, it can be a little bit difficult to evaluate and determine what that moderate patient looks like. And, you know, maybe being a little bit nervous to expose a patient to systemic therapy if maybe they're kind of teetering on the line between mild to moderate. So, Jamie, I want to ask you, do you speak with other PAs and MPs that maybe are in that category where it's difficult for them to determine that moderate patient? And how would you define moderate psoriasis in your clinic?
I do. In fact, you know, I practice in Michigan, right? Even in the geographical area that I practice in, there is a large practice and they do not allow any of their APPs to go ahead and prescribe biologics unless it's run through the dermatologist and they prefer to prescribe. And so it's very hard. It is very hard. It's different throughout the entire country. Where I am, I have a very supportive physicians that I work with, and my supervising physician is very supportive and very independent in my role. In fact, the physicians that I work with all come to me, and they respect the fact that I'm the specialist with patients with psoriasis, and I treat with all of the therapies for psoriasis for patients. I have a true passion for treating those patients, and I really love that. I really feel bad when other people are not allowed to do that. And actually, we have a journal club. And what they do actually is they go ahead and refer. And I think that's what we do. Even if we have a patient with PSA that we feel we've talked about the PSA patients, I manage mostly all of my PSA patients. There's only if there's something that just doesn't add up and it's not quite right, then I refer out to rheumatology. But it's the patient first. It's always the patient first. It's not about keeping the numbers. It's about the patient first. The other thing is how I go ahead and look at the patients with moderate psoriasis is that when patients come in, I really look at a full body exam. And so especially if they have psoriasis in high impact areas, such as the face, the hands, the feet, the genital areas, lots of times that's a lot less than 3% BSA. You know, the 3% BSA to 10% is the NPFs looking at that. That's their classification. However, the AAD is a little bit different, but the AAD also says it can be less than 5% for those sensitive areas, such as the hands, the feet, the face, and the groin areas. Psychologically, you know, it's really important. Their quality of life is so important. You may even have plaques on the knees and the lower legs that are just so thick that because of what they do, they're cracking open all the time, and it's extremely uncomfortable. I had a gentleman who was a crane operator, and he came to me because of the fact that he had psoriasis so bad on the gluteal cleft, the back of his buttocks, and extending onto the posterior upper leg. And he said to me, I literally am going to have to quit my job because I am so uncomfortable. I cannot sit in this crane and have these plaques cracking. They hurt so terrible. And in the summertime, I sweat. And then the sweat gets in there and it stings so terribly. And so literally, did he really have a large amount of body surface area? No, he didn't. But the impact of that body surface area was huge. And it affected his quality of life. Even when we look at inverse psoriasis for patients, sexuality, we are all sexual beings. And it doesn't matter how large that area of psoriasis is in the inverse area. It affects our confidence as well as our comfort when doing something that's completely natural to us, our sexual ability. And so we really need to look at that. So moderate, he has a variation. We need to look at the impact on life. We need to look at the thickness of the plaques and where they are. We need to also look at those special areas, such as the hands, the face, you know, the feet and the hands. I also want to share with you, I had a gentleman too that he was a number one seller, and he in sales, and he developed plaque psoriasis on his face. And he was told by his employer that he was being let go. And he was being let go because he was not face friendly anymore. So these are things that we're just not talking about a small area. And lots of times too, when we talk about an area like the face, we have to do either non-steroidal preparations or steroid preparations that are very low potency, and they don't always work. And so we really need to think about this. And when I have patients that come in for a first time and they have moderate to psoriasis, if they've never been treated at all, I will allow them, you know, I will put them on topical therapy, but I treat them with topical therapy usually for a short period of time, 2 to 3 weeks, and then I see them back. I don't say I'll see you in 6 months. And I think that that's really important for our care too.
So I know one of the hindrances that we have in practice can be insurance. So even when we have a patient that comes in that we feel meets the criteria for a systemic therapy, whether it's, you know, they have it in those sensitive areas, maybe they don't have 3 to 10% BSA, but you know, it's in the genital area, it's affecting their quality of life. Insurance tends to dictate what we can provide for our patients, which is really a disservice to the patient, but, you know, we kind of feel a little handcuffed there. Terry, do you run into that in your practice? And maybe do you find that there's some things that you can include in the note that tends to help in this area where we want to give patients systemic therapy, but we know that we may run into a blockade, if you will, in that area?
No, definitely. I mean, I think that definitely insurance companies and especially the world of prior authorizations, we can all attest that it it definitely adds a different touch to our day most of the times, especially with these patients. I find that honestly, I mean, I still go back to the basics of really, you know, just like Jamie said, patient first. I really do. And so for me, a lot of it is fighting for the patient in regards to, hey, this is what is going on. So if I have a patient that has, you know, 3% so far as a 4% so far as BSA, but that patient may have significant nail involvement as well too. And what does that mean? That patient is not able to work with their hands as much. It's a case where they have tender so far as, I mean, I had a patient recently that had, she couldn't even plait her daughter's hair. Just the fact that she was just like, my hands hurt so badly. She was like, my nails are breaking off, all those different things. She said, just the fact to be able to plait my 9-year-old twin's hair, she was just like, it's a chore. So when you really kind of just put together all the pieces of just like, okay, the impact, yes, of what, you know, what is classified as a moderate, you know, few plaques here and there that are obviously bothersome to the patient. But truly, I think it goes back to the quality of life. And what this impact really has on patients, I think that it truly, really, in my heart, it redefines what moderate and to severe is, because truly, it's like almost you can ask a patient, you know, well, define what, you know, would you classify this as moderate, you know, or severe or mild? What would you come back at? And I could tell them what my aspect of how I would diagnose them, or, you know, are you mild, moderate, and severe? And that patient may come back and say, no, this is severe. This totally impacts my day-to-day existence. And I think in turn, I think when we kind of begin to look at that, I think that we can then kind of go to bat on paper and definitely try to justify that. Because I think at the end of the day, it's a case where if patients know that we're fighting for them, you know, it's amazing. They know when they, especially when they've been to multiple derms or multiple offices in the past and they haven't been put on anything, they've only been giving creams. And when they come across a provider that, man, this is what's going on, this is what we're going to do, we're going to fight to get it for you, it warms their heart, I think, honestly, for many patients. But at the same time, it lets them know that they've been heard, that they're being taken serious. And you know what? Somebody's fighting for me. And if they're willing to do that, then that speaks volumes.
You know, and speaking of some of these new therapies that we, you know, may or may not have to fight insurance for. We've been very lucky that we've had some new therapies come to market, specifically systemic therapies. And I wanted to talk about those. Terry, what are some of the newer therapies? We'll kind of keep it to systemic that you are utilizing in your practice and where you have found that they have been helpful for you.
I would say definitely newer therapies so far as that have come to market, especially recently within, I would say, maybe the last 5 years, at least in the oral landscape. Obviously, we have deucravacitinib that's been a novel agent, especially when we're talking about treating patients with, honestly, mild to moderate, and even honestly, moderate to severe so far as psoriasis as well, too, dealing with it. It's been great as an oral agent to be able to have been able to achieve certain levels of efficacy when you're looking at so far as their PASI, their PASI 75 data as well as PASI 90 is very impressive as an oral. And then at the same time, obviously, we have other agents in the, in the IL-17. You have other agents that have definitely come through, even in the IL-23s, and we're utilizing. I think that it's amazing that we've become a lot more targeted. Our safety profile has become a lot more cleaner. And then not only that, our educations have gotten even better. So it's kind of like we're in a stage where I always say it's a buffet. Yeah. How it feels like when you go to a buffet at a, at a restaurant, and you're just like, oh man, it's gonna be some good eating here. So all you can eat.
Yeah. Jamie, I know you have experience with all of the systemics and biologics. Let's speak just for a second. Usually when we talk about systemics, we often think about oral therapies. With deucravacitinib getting its approval, talk to us a little bit about your experience and your knowledge around their pivotal trials. I know POETIC 1 and POETIC 2. Let's talk a little bit about those.
Well, when we look at those particular clinical trials that were done, that was POETIC 1 and POETIC 2 for psoriasis. We look at the we evaluated at 16 weeks, and their primary endpoint was 75. Also, they had an active competitor, which is apremilast. And, at 16 weeks, when you look at the PASI 75, you had over half of those patients responding at 16 weeks. We're not talking about a large molecule. We're talking about a small molecule. So when you talk about a small molecule, that is really very, very, as far as the safety, the efficacy, and that with the small molecule and the results that we're seeing are very good. The one thing too is that this medication and POETIC 1 and POETIC 2, a secondary endpoint, was looking at the PASI of 90. And those patients with a PASI of 90 also responded very well. The one thing too is that you'll see that those patients that were responders, as it went out in the clinical trials, those patients also continued to respond, but they also did improve within their response rates too. It's really nice to know that with a medication like this, that as far as the safety and efficacy, that the dosing, it's a once a day dosing, and there's not an interaction with other medications that are being taken. The side effect profile is very low, especially when they looked at the side effect profile in comparison to apremilast. I think that that data really gives us confidence in knowing that when we put a patient on this oral medication, that this medication does have its safety and efficacy. Also, the one thing is that a lot of providers need to know what labs to do for baseline labs prior to starting medications. And for this particular medication, it is a TB test. However, if the patient does have a history of liver enzymes being elevated or liver dysfunction, you need to do a CMP prior.
Harry, when we talk about deucravacitinib and their pivotal trials, Jamie just mentioned that it went head-to-head against apremilast. I know apremilast has kind of been our kind of really gold standard when we think of systemic therapy in the past, probably, gosh, it seems like almost a decade now. And it definitely has its utility. It's indicated for mild disease, which is very beneficial for when we have those patients that we're treating that have mild disease. We've treated them topically, but they're just not getting where we need them to be. And so I've definitely utilized apremilast in my clinical practice. But we know that there are some tolerability issues with that one. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with apremilast, and now we have deucravacitinib. Jamie just mentioned that they saw a better safety profile when we look at tolerability of these GI issues, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headache. How has that impacted your clinical practice? Are you using deucravacitinib where maybe you used to think of apremilast? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I found myself either at times starting patients that I would consider to be patients that I would put on apremilast and go ahead and go to deucravacitinib, or even some patients that I've switched that potentially had a lot of some of the side effects that of the, whether it be nausea, the diarrhea, and certain things that were unsettling for them over time. They were just like, okay, if there's another option, I wouldn't mind switching too. That a lot of times I've found that I've definitely switched in that direction. But just like you said, I mean, just to Jamie's point, I mean, the clinical data really just kind of, when you really unpack POETIC 1 and 2, and I think that one thing that, you know, we kind of overlook, and you just really look at just the secondary endpoint saying that a PASI 90, when you really just kind of unpack that, a PASI 90 as an oral agent once a day dosing. And not only does it just surpass, I mean, when you really look at the data, it really truly surpasses so far as apremilast, to the fact that I believe that even when we're looking at the PASI 75 so far as data, you're seeing about at least over 50% of patients achieving so far as that PASI 75 compared to about 33 to 35% of those patients being in the apremilast arm. So you definitely see definitely increase of efficacy, which I think patients are looking for. So I've had definitely a few patients that were apremilast patients that I felt like were still kind of teetering through. They were, you know, they weren't, you know, miserable, but just like we talked about, if you know better, you do better. You give them the opportunity. You're just like, okay, well, I feel like we can definitely get some better clearance here. And I've switched over, and the amount of efficacy and clearance that I saw was phenomenal. Patient was happy. They're just like, okay, well, awesome. I still maintained to be on the oral. They weren't ready to kind of go to anything injectable in nature. And so we're still able to achieve their goals in that sense. So that was pretty nice. But I think that really, when you just really look at the aspect of how deucrava really works, just as, you know, a TYK2 inhibitor, you really kind of just really, it makes sense in a lot of ways when we're looking at the safety profile and things like that. You're just like, okay, this really small molecule is really able to, it's a small molecule, yet it has a powerful punch to it. And so that's an amazing part, at least in regards to this drug.
Yeah, I think it's really amazing that it is an oral medication, but yet when we look at efficacy, it really is kind of going up there against the biologics. We're seeing some numbers that we would typically reserve for biologics. You know, you just touched on something I wanted to talk about, which is the mechanism of action. We know it's a TYK2 inhibitor, and it is in that JAK family, but there are some differences and some nuances there. So when we talk about educating our peers, I know that there's a lot of PAs and MPs that are still trying to kind of unpack that mechanism of action. We know that deucravacitinib, it's a TYK2 inhibitor. It's in the JAK family. There's definitely some nuances. It is not a JAK inhibitor, and that can be very confusing for some. Terry, how do you kind of describe this mechanism of action? What are the differences between TYK2 inhibition and JAK inhibition? We'll start with that. And then I want to talk about how you talk to your patients about this new class of medication.
Gotcha. Just like we said, I mean, it's a case where it definitely falls within the JAK family. But it definitely, so far as I think that we look at families, I always say that, you know what, we're all different. It's a case where you can have four kids and then all of a sudden we all bear the same last name, but you know, we're all kind of a little bit funny. So, and I think that in some ways that's really kind of, we really look at it. We sit back and say, you know what, you know, when we're looking at TYK2 and JAK2, yes, it's a case when we're talking about in regards to just that it falls underneath the family aspect, but structurally and mechanistically, it's very different in how it responds and signals compared so far as to the JAKs. And so when you're really looking at what really makes it different, when we're talking about the regulatory domain and then obviously the active domain in itself is kind of like that active static aspect, and true when we're talking about the ATP binding site in that sense. And so we see that definitely that aspect doesn't change. That domain in itself is kind of like thinking of something that's fixed. Whereas the regulatory domain, when you're talking about the pseudokinase, so far as domain there, that's where structurally, so far as they're very different. And so I think that when we're talking about so far as TYK2, a lot of times we then, you know, it puts under the umbrella, because I've heard that before. People are just like, ah, it's just another JAK. And you're just like, no, no, no. There's a reason why, when you look at the data and you say that, okay, well, why am I not seeing the same signal so far as in TYK2 that I would see so far as in some of the other JAKs? And even in itself, it all depends on its pairing. We're looking at so far as TYK2, and when it pairs so far as to JAK2 is different if it's pairing so far as to JAK1 or any of the other JAKs. So I think that when we put that broad classification, we see that, okay, when we're looking with TYK2, we're looking at so far as those immunospecific type of responses, whereas obviously there's a much broader response when we're looking at JAK inhibition. And so that's when we look at so far as there's that hemopoietic type of responses that we see. You see a lot more so far as things that go on, whether it be coagulation and things like that, that kind of play a part there. So I think more than anything, one, it's definitely understanding how they're different. And I think then when we see the data, it makes sense. But to your point, when I'm trying to explain to patients more than anything, because obviously they've seen a commercial when they're just like, okay, you know, lay it on me. What is it going to keep me safe? Is it, you know, what's going to happen to me? And then I think at the end of the day, you tell them that, hey, you know, I know that you've seen the commercials on TV. I know it's probably a little scary, but you know what? This drug is not scary. This drug has the ability to really transform your psoriasis. And so you then talk about, hey, it is in a class of a family, but hey, it mechanistically acts very different so far as than its other siblings. And this is how and what makes it different. But not only that, it has the ability, that's where it falls within the cascade. We're talking about IL-23 and IL-17. And we see that TYK2 is that mediator, is that intracellular mediator that makes a difference so far as within the pathway. So if we're able to definitely bind TYK2, and then we're able to kind of definitely inhibit so far as that interaction downstream, it makes a big difference so far as to the plaques and the things that come, you know, that proceed so far as psoriasis. So I think at the end of the day, I always find that patients, if we're comfortable as providers, and if we're confident, then we explain it confidently. And then in turn, amazingly, the distrust or the questions become simmered, because it's just like, okay, you know what, they've explained it to me. Yeah, they don't have any problems with it. But if we come off like, you know what, got this drug that's kind of has all these things, then they're looking at you just like, well, you know, okay, well, I don't know how you feel the way you feel. I don't know. I don't want to feel that way. So I think at the end of the day, then it falls on us as providers to make sure, you know what, let me explain to the patient if I feel comfortable in this drug, but I only feel comfortable if I understand. And then I think that's where many of us over time, you know, when many of these molecules launched initially, there was kind of just that side eye component of people just like, I don't know, you know, I don't know how I feel. But at the end of the day, it's just like, you know what, we have to unpack it. We need to understand it. These molecules are not going away, and they shouldn't go away. At the end of the day, they have the ability to transform lives. So what we have to do is that we have to, you know, we definitely have to just increase our understanding of these, of the molecules that are in front of us and how they have the benefit so far as to our patients.
I agree. And I love that analogy. I heard something like that, similar, where we talk about the regulatory domain and the active domain. And we look at the active domain, think of all of these, TYK2, JAK1, 2, and 3, all as being siblings, and your active domain is your last name. So that remains pretty much the same, not identical, but very, very similar. And then your regulatory domain is your first name, and that first name is different. And that's where you see the differences across the class. And then I think the biggest thing when you talk to patients is, yes, it's within this family, but it did not get that box warning. And there's a reason why I didn't get that box warning. But Terry, in your practice, I know you've been doing this for a long time, but how would you explain to maybe someone that's newer, that's maybe 1 to 5 years out of school, that's now being kind of bombarded with all of these new therapies, which we are very blessed to have, but with it being so overwhelming, how would you describe to them how they can go about choosing what systemic therapy or biologic therapy would be best for the patient? What do you take into account?
I think at the end of the day, I'd kind of take into account truly the whole patient. I mean, it's funny, I had this discussion. It's a case where I was talking to someone yesterday and she was a new grad, same. And I told her, I was just like, you know what? I said, we truly are in a landscape so far as, you know, now that there's so many options available. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, talking to your kids that, you know, we are now in the digital age and my kids have no recollection of, you know, what it was to have a phone and, you know, a regular phone and a beeper and different stuff like that. That's like foreign. And it's kind of the same thing. There's not that appreciation of the years, 20, 30 years beforehand when there was nothing in the landscape. So in truth, you then find you kind of follow that up and you're just like, you know what? It truly then kind of falls on the education component of being like, why do I choose what I choose? But I choose it based upon who's in front of me. And so you go back and you say, okay, well, I'm looking at this patient. If I have a patient that, you know, whether they're a young patient, and that makes a difference too, whether I have a patient in their, you know, mid-30s versus a patient that is, you know, in their 60s that now has psoriasis, or there's a Medicare age patient. A lot of times, definitely, sometimes, unfortunately, you know, insurance may dictate where I kind of go with my Medicare patient. I may have a couple of options that are available that I feel like, you know what, access wise, I can get. And I still feel sufficiently that they feel tick off the boxes in regards to being able to help that patient. But an overall, when we're looking at commercial payer patients and the different things like that, that I take into consideration, okay, am I dealing with a female of childbearing potential? Is this patient, even if she is a female, you know, does she plan to get pregnant so far as in the next couple of years or even recently? Is it a patient that, you know, what potentially has, you know, PSA as well too, because I'm screening for that as well. So a multitude of options that kind of go in. If do I have a patient that's severely overweight, and we're talking about so far as, you know, we're talking about metabolic syndrome and things like that. So you then begin to unpack and say, you know what, okay, this agent, when I'm looking at a 17 or a 23, and then I'm looking at obviously so far as a side effect profile in regards to all these, then I then kind of mechanistically choose, okay, which drug do I feel will work better for that patient? The great thing about options is a case where, you know what, if one agent doesn't fit for one patient, then you know what? We can then pivot and move to another. I think sometimes our algorithms get a little bit flustered because a lot of times the thought process, so long has been we go to topicals, we go to orals, then we go to injectables. And then you truth, and you're just like, you know, that there's no rhyme and reason to that. You can sit back and say, I can have a patient that's on an injectable and they may not be doing well, but you know what? Deucravacitinib may be a great option for them and it's an oral. So there's no rhyme that sits back and say, I have to go in this stepwise fashion. It's saying that tailor it to the patient that's in front of you. And I think I kind of go back to that notion and I think it kind of simplifies it. But I mean, truly, I kind of let them know, you know what? I mean, we really do have great options. It's not like you're at a buffet where, you know, some is good and some is not so great. It's really saying, you know what, there are really great options. I think you're just making sure that you're keeping the patient safe, but you're taking into account all their comorbidities that may exist or potentially are in the forefront that they need to know about and you need to know about. Because we know that patients, some can be very good historians, some are not. And so sometimes you definitely have to kind of, you know, go back to the drawing board and say, okay, this is what's going on with you. Okay, if you're a patient that you are someone that has potentially have osteomyelitis and other chronic infections, then you know what? I may have to kind of tailor my therapy based on that. And or if you have a history of malignancies, you know, then I may need to double check and make sure, you know, converse with your oncologist and say, hey, I've had that case where I've had somebody who had colorectal cancer, they got treated, and patient was like, okay, in a lot of ways, patient was just like, oh, well, I can only go on these. And their oncologist was just like, no, they need a systemic. No, it's like, so I'm collaborating with you to say his disease is so severe that, you know what, this has the ramifications. He's not on a systemic. Actually, his, you know, the likelihood of his colorectal could potentially flare even more just because of just the amount of systemic inflammation that was in his body. So things like that, when you collaborate across the board, I think kind of gives us a lot more confidence.
And I think one of the biggest things we talk about to patient preferences, specifically oral versus injectable, that's big. And I've heard differences among providers on how they talk to their patients about that and when they inject the word oral versus biologic or injectable in the conversation. It's different for everybody. Jamie, when you talk to a patient about the options, do you find that oral versus biologic or injectable, that those words can make a big difference to patients? And when do you kind of put those words in the conversation? Do you put them right up front when you say, hey, we have this oral new molecule, deucravacitinib, we have this injectable biologic? How do you talk to patients about that?
Well, lots of times, you know, first of all, I just educate patients on their disease first, because I think they need to know about their disease and the fact and why we need to treat it and why it's important to treat it. But then when I talk about medications, oral medications for a lot of patients, they are interpreted as a safer form of therapy. I think that's why when apremilast came to market, and they did a great job when they brought it also to social media as well as television, that it just seemed to be a very safe alternative compared to watching these commercials that had the injectable biologics on it, where they felt like they needed to go ahead and run to a lawyer and get their last will and testament, you know, completed. And that's really what it feels like. That's the heavy magnitude of it. However, a lot of people too are very well educated in methotrexate. So when you talk about DMARD therapy and you talk about methotrexate, and they're like, no, I'm not going on that one. I've heard about that. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's why when you talk about medications, and insurance is just a reality. And lots of times, I mean, either we can go through the path of doing a DMARD as if it's appropriate for a patient and educating them regarding DMARDs, or we can go ahead and do an early entry type program. But oral medications are a very good option. You know, I just like Terry was saying, you know, there's no one approach. It's not a cookie cutter approach for patients. The other thing is I tell people, you know, I'd like to, you know, hit that ball out of the ballpark and make that home run the first time, and we have clearance and bring you that, literally that skin comfort and what it's like not to live with psoriasis every day. But you are an individual. So I really talk to them about all the forms of therapy, and they do rely on me as the professional to tell them and to bring them, you know, into a direction that would be appropriate for them. And so, yes, but people do have a very strong opinion, a lot of patients, whether it's an oral therapy or an injectable therapy. And a lot of patients would still rather have an oral therapy, as comparison to an injectable therapy. And that's fine. That is great. As long as it's an appropriate therapy for that patient, it's definitely a treatment option.
All right. To sum up today, we have a lot, we unpacked a lot, but Jamie and I, why don't we go over some key takeaways from today's discussion? I know the first thing that we spoke about today was that plaque psoriasis really goes beyond the skin. Honestly, all of the inflammatory skin diseases really go well beyond the skin. We know that there are numerous systemic comorbidities that go along with plaque psoriasis, and something I'm very passionate about, the psychosocial impact of the disease, which really to me proves why systemic therapy is so beneficial for these patients. We also talked about the different severities and how some patients are still being undertreated, and in some cases not treated at all. And often it's those moderate patients that kind of fall in the middle that can sometimes be underserved, which, you know, I hope that providers will, think about what they consider moderate disease. We know what the guidelines say, but taking into account quality of life, is the affected areas in those sensitive areas, you know, palmar plantar, genital, is it facial? We talked about the developments of some really cool novel oral options. We also have some new biologic therapies that are on the market that are similar, but not the same. We know with deucravacitinib, that is probably the newest systemic agent on the market. It's got a very novel mechanism of action, and thus it also has a different safety profile. It doesn't have the box warning that members of other members in that class have. And then Jamie, I'm going to let you kind of talk further about some of the other things that we discussed. We talked about, you know, what are good candidates for systemic therapies, patient preferences, and how we choose. What are some of your key takeaways from today's discussion?
Actually, I'd like to take off where you just ended.
Okay.
And describe it and deucravacitinib. When we talk about JAK, I think that it's really important when we talk about that oral particular medication that we look at its mechanism of action. We really talked about how that it's so important because it falls between the IL-23 and the IL-17. It's different. I think that it was really some really great takeaways with the analogies that were used about first names and last names in regards to the active domain and the regulatory domain. The first name being your active domain, so that for every person in the family, they have a first name and they're different, and yet their last name is the same. And so I think that's very important, and it follows that inflammatory pathway. It is specifically targets that inflammation, and yet you don't have the other side effects that you have that come along with JAK1, JAK2, JAK3 that have that activation. We don't see that. So I think that those were important components that we talked about today. And not everybody knows everything. And if you don't know everything, or if you're in a practice that you have a supervising physician that doesn't allow you to go ahead and provide the type of therapy that patients need, then to refer those patients to somebody who can.
Mm-hmm. Well, and still for those providers that maybe are not able to provide care utilizing some of these systemic drugs or biologics, doesn't mean don't educate yourself on those, because you never know when you may be in a different practice. As I just changed practices a year ago, you know, things change, life changes, probably as quickly as the landscape for psoriasis treatments has changed. So, you know, educate yourself, even if you aren't able to utilize those therapies. And like you said, refer out. And then I think finally, finding a mentor is important. I wish that I had had, I have had someone, a physician. I didn't work with this physician, but he lent himself to me early on and helped me kind of get my footing to where I felt comfortable starting to prescribe these products. I wish that I'd had an APP, a PA or an MP, early on that would have taken me under their wing and said, hey, here's what I would do, and give me some help. And so I feel really strongly about providing that to my colleagues and my peers. And so, you know, if you're somebody that wants to learn more, don't be afraid to reach out and ask somebody if they'd be willing to, you know, share their knowledge with you. And if you're somebody like Jamie and I that have been in practice for a really long time, think about where you were when you started and what you needed, and be that for somebody else. So I hope everybody has enjoyed the content. You can subscribe to the newsletters so that you can receive new and upcoming Medcast episodes and then other great content to your inbox. So I am Lauren Miller, and thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.